Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us, and this is an edition that I've been looking forward to for a long time. You'll understand in just a moment as Lee Todd, host of our series on connecting education and economic development, introduces our first guest. And apologies in advance for any confusion.
Today I'm talking to Dr. Thomas Martin, Associate Provost for Research and Development at EKU, Eastern Kentucky University. Welcome to the show, Tom.
Dr. Todd, thanks for having me, and I've enjoyed the conversations that you and I have had leading up to today and look forward to our discussion.
Well, tell us a little bit about yourself. What have you been doing?
Currently, I'm the Associate Provost for Research and Economic Development, as you mentioned, and how I got here was the work that I did at the Council on Postsecondary Education. I was the Senior Fellow for Research and Economic Policy, and I'd only been there a few months when actually you stepped down, Dr. Todd, as President, but it was at CPE that I first heard you talk about the Kentucky uglies, diabetes, obesity, smoking, infant mortality, those things that were endemic to Kentucky. And the UK and the other public universities should be focused on that. And that was a big influence on how I started to think about what research universities should do. Soon thereafter, I had the extraordinary opportunity to spend a couple days on the campus of North Carolina State and UNC Chapel Hill visiting with the chancellors there. And like you, they were and are big believers that universities are engines of innovation, that universities are compelled to solve big problems, like the ones that you had advocated, that we are the application of original knowledge by our faculty and students at some level is our public service. And while redesigning a better lemonade stand has its utility, solving those Kentucky uglies for universities is our public service. And so my work centered around those universities working together on issues such as those. I was at CPE for a few years and then was recruited by Eastern's current president, Dr. David McFadden, when he was in his previous role, to take this larger statewide agenda and think about how to build it up at EKU, how to build up EKU's research, economic, and entrepreneurial enterprise.
I've said for too many years, Kentucky citizens thought of the universities for entertainment in the way of sports and so forth, and education, obviously, but not economic development. And if you look in the East and West Coast, that's what they've been doing to really build their economy. So I'm excited about hearing about the mission of your office. So tell us what you do.
So my office provides broad vision and executive leadership that supports the research, creativity, innovation, commercialization, and entrepreneurship as essential components of Eastern's mission, as well as economic development activities in coordination with the region, the state, and other external partners. EKU is a teaching university first and foremost. That is our unfair competitive advantage. But our faculty are also actively engaged in research, and because of that, we are compelled to accelerate and apply innovation, solve problems, and to compete to make things better. And those activities have a natural entrepreneurial focus. You know, where you went to school at MIT, that was embedded in the culture, and that's what we're trying to do here. So my office is trying to, how do we take these activities like research and innovation, commercialization, entrepreneurship, and how does that become imbued in our university?
What are some of the economic development opportunities that you think are offered as potential for the Eastern Kentucky region?
The 21st century economy is about creating jobs versus getting a job. This is a great opportunity for people to start thinking about how they can create jobs. So let me mention three opportunities, and we can go from there. One would be a real opportunity is in Kentucky's number one export, which is aerospace. It's more aero than space today, and Eastern leads the way with we have the only flight school in the state that offers four-year degrees, but you also have companies like Space Tango up in Lexington that are hopping on the back of SpaceX rockets and doing zero-gravity experiments at the International Space Station on everything from barley hops to cancer to blindness. And so that's a real opportunity for us. Kentucky is second in the country behind Washington State and ahead of California in terms of exports in the aerospace sector. But how do we keep that competitive advantage? I think it's a really important policy question for the state. That'd be one. The second would be, and particularly in Eastern Kentucky, the agricultural technology sector. You have companies like AppHarvest that are over in Moorhead that are building 60-acre greenhouses that combine agriculture and tech to grow organic foods 365 days a year. They do it with 90% less water, 40% less utility. But ag tech is also, how does the ag community use drones, satellites for weather forecasting, automated irrigation, controlled greenhouses, and the like? So I think ag tech is another opportunity. And then the third, which would be for how to invest in these ideas, is opportunity zones. These are low-income, distressed, and contiguous census tracts defined by the federal government, where investors can receive significant federal tax breaks and deferrals for investing in a variety of economic projects, particularly in these blighted communities. I'm working with a couple of alumni right now on projects in Eastern Kentucky, and they are using the opportunity zones as an effort to invest in advanced manufacturing, tourism, and 3D printing, just to name three. And so I think those are three things. Aerospace, ag tech, and opportunity zones are opportunities to advance economic development in our service region.
You mentioned entrepreneurship. How do you feel about the feeling of entrepreneurship among your student body at this point in time?
Well, I think the outlook is all upside, really. We think about COVID-19, for example, and how that's impacted our economy, and it has. But so did the Great Recession. But out of that, I can think of three areas that really exploded: the sharing economy, software as service, and sustainability initiatives. They really accelerated coming out of the Great Recession. So we need to create an environment where downtimes like COVID, how can those times be accelerated for innovation? The other big thing is we just honestly do not know what the next big thing is. We don't know what the next innovation is. We don't know what industry that is. We don't know what discipline that is. And if you'd have told me or a million other people that sleeping overnight in a stranger's house was a business model, we would have had them fitted for a straitjacket. But that's Airbnb with a, you know, multi-billion dollar valuation. So we need to encourage and support ideas, no matter where the idea comes from, no matter the discipline, because we don't know what that thing is that's going to be 6 months down the road. And this is where places like EKU can partner with research universities like University of Kentucky and U of L to connect and leverage resources to spur entrepreneurial growth. One example that's new to Kentucky, Dr. Todd, is the Kentucky Commercialization Ventures, which is a program between the Kentucky Science and Technology Corporation and the Cabinet for Economic Development, along with the public universities, including EKU, that partners entrepreneurs with faculty to investigate the market worthiness of technologies, starting companies, entrepreneurial activities. And this is a new and exciting development for Kentucky.
You've touched on it a bit, but what are some of the resources or opportunities people can have with, and get in touch with your office? How could you help them do some things that they might be thinking about?
One of the things that we do currently for our faculty, my office, along with President McFadden and our Board of Regents, have developed an innovation fund that to date has awarded $500,000 to faculty, students, and staff that, under a parameter of addressing a problem in our region, offering a solution, and then showing a return on those investments. Of those awards in the last 2 years, three of those have led to patents, and we're very excited about those opportunities at the university level. What we're doing in the future is we want to set up a fund that would seed ideas that would increase the development of not only faculties and student entrepreneurs, but local entrepreneurs around the community that provide people the opportunity where appropriate to invest in new endeavors. From the university standpoint, research and intellectual property that we produce is an asset of the university, and it is our responsibility to deploy that asset. But it's also a responsibility of the university to centralize that opportunity for people in the community that can then go out and be able to start their own opportunity.
You've talked about the importance of the humanities, not only in this world now as we're complicated and we're telling people you got to get an education and get a job, so go to one of the STEM areas, which I like those areas, but how do you feel about the merger between STEM and humanities in an education?
Well, our lives would be very dull, dry, and boring without the humanities. Without art, our life would be pretty miserable. And so I think when we kind of draw back and look at what the humanities do for us, the focus on humanities, particularly in Kentucky, the ability to think critically about not just issues related to something that's in a book, but how do we solve problems related to issues in Kentucky? How do we improve our civil discourse? How do we take really complex problems and then as a community drive to solve those problems? But also in the notion that you can't major in something like art and make money at it, or that there's no job for that, I would just point to the Hamilton musical made by Lin-Manuel Miranda, who was a double major in theater and art direction. If Hamilton, the musical, was only in New York City, he would be making about $10 million a year for the rest of his life. But it's in San Francisco, it's in London, it's in Houston, it's in Chicago. And so someone who's an entrepreneur who could also create that job, that can be done from any discipline. And what we have to do as a university, whether it be EKU or UK or whoever, is to make those students feel like they have that opportunity that no matter what their discipline is, they can go out and create that job and create that opportunity for themselves and for their families.
Well, I've been talking to Dr. Thomas Martin, the Associate Provost for Research and Economic Development at Eastern Kentucky University, who's doing some very exciting things to try to change the way that we think about economic development and how we employ our research. Thank you a lot, Tom.
Thank you, Dr. Todd.
And yes, Tom Martin and I do sometimes get each other's emails. The U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics has projected that demand for welders would grow by 26% by 2020. Well, if the numbers pan out, it would make welding one of the fastest-growing professions in America. It's a highly skilled trade that requires a lot of training. And that's what Sean Gannon does. It's what he has been doing, even under pandemic conditions, as an assistant professor in the Certified Welding Educator Program at Bluegrass Community and Technical College in Lexington. And he joins us to talk about what he's seeing from his corner on the front lines of training people for careers in construction and manufacturing. Thanks for joining us, Sean.
Thank you for having me.
Talk to us about that demand. What does the job market look like for the people you're training?
Well, the demand for welders, you can do a simple Google search for welder demand and you'll find all kinds of numbers. The American Welding Society really is the overseer of everything that is welding in America. And I think it was in 1988, there were around 570,000 welders. And by 2012, there's only 360,000. And by 2020, it's estimated that we're going to be down to about 290,000 deficit. Those are jobs available. And the deficit is because there are so many older welders in the field who are retiring and younger people aren't coming up and replacing those welders. So there's a lot of demand. It is not a day doesn't go by where I don't receive four or five phone calls from companies all over the country asking me, do you have welders ready to go? How fast can we get them through? How soon can you get them to us? And I can't graduate them fast enough.
Wow. What industries are most in demand of these new welders?
Well, here in Kentucky, you would have companies like Qualex and any number of companies that would be putting a lot of manufacturing pieces and parts together, either for heavy equipment or for the auto industry or mining industry, the crane building industry. Those are central Kentucky jobs that you can go out and find a job. There's a lot of building downtown in Lexington right now where those welders are certified, very experienced, and they're still short on welders there. But it's not just everybody who can go in and just get that job and be trained on the job like you could in some other fields. You really need some experience in a technical college or in a technical school where you can really kind of learn the trade and some of the theory that comes behind the welding that you're doing.
Is the enrollment in your training at capacity, or do you have a lot of seats available?
I have been here since 2012, and I have never had a seat available when classes started.
Huh. Well, I'm wondering, what's it been like now for you to do this work, this training, and also keep yourself and your students safe from COVID-19?
Well, BCTC has been very responsible about keeping everything. We had to go through a complete new education about how we were going to interact with students and with each other. It took us a while. We made several proposals to the governor's office because we had so many people who weren't able to be trained from January to May. So we had to make up those courses. And like many other teachers are now just going back into high schools and going back into elementary schools, I've been teaching in person to about 20 people since May.
Have these pandemic restrictions and measures like distancing and wearing masks, have those things complicated the training experience?
When I look back, in the beginning, I felt very overwhelmed and it was very complicated. But once people got over the fact that I had to ask them several times to repeat things, or they would have to ask me to repeat things because the mask muffles the sounds and it's hard to hear each other and we can't get very close. Once you get used to that, everything starts to kind of come together. But I have two shops and I have 10 people in one shop and 10 people in another, and the capacity is for 12 or 13. So there's plenty of room to spread out. But it takes a lot, and it's really nerve-wracking for me because I don't know where students have been. Students don't know where I have been. But fortunately, people here are taking everything really seriously, and they wear a mask, and they don't ask questions. They just want to get through school.
Are there particular key skills, talents that make a big difference in a student's success and their prospects out on the job market?
The most important thing in terms of getting a job right now on the market is if you can pass a drug test, and if you can be on time, and if you can communicate in a professional way. So if you can communicate through email and through texting and through however you're going to communicate with your peers in your industry, the better you do in those situations, the more likely you are to get a job. Most of the time, if you have enough technical training, they're even willing to train you further once you get there, as long as you have good soft skills to enter the job force.
Is welding dangerous work? How do you minimize error, that kind of thing?
Welding can be dangerous, but if you understand that you're really melting metal with electricity or with an acetylene torch, as long as you understand how to prepare for those things with the right PPE, just like you would with any of the things that you would do in healthcare or anything else, you just have to be trained and understand what PPE needs to be worn. And if you understand electricity a little bit and understand how things work, then it's relatively safe if you do things right.
That thing about not looking directly at the light, that it could damage your eyes, is that true, or has the science come along now to mitigate that problem?
The only science that has come along to mitigate that problem is an auto-darkening lens that would be on a helmet, that a lens that's on the helmet that recognizes the light is on and it automatically darkens to the point where you can watch the weld. But if you're ever out and you see someone welding and you don't have the proper eye protection, easily you could burn your eyes. And it's something that happens to welders throughout their career occasionally. It's not a nice feeling.
Can you do precision work when you're looking through that lens?
Yeah, actually, the lens that you're looking through is not much more than your regular sight. It wouldn't be any different than looking through a pair of glasses. You really have to get close to the weld and watch it closely. There's a lot going on within welding that you have to pay very close attention to the detail all the time.
And I'm curious, Sean, why did you decide to get into welding?
Well, for many years, I was an artist. Before I got into welding, I knew how to weld a little bit. My dad had shown me a little bit about welding, but I felt like if I was really going to excel in big sculpture pieces, I really needed to go to school. So I entered school. I was 40 years old. Most of my life I had spent in sales and in politics. And in 2008, 9, and 10, you know, the economy was horrible. There weren't that many jobs. So I went back to school. I went to BCTC. I graduated in 2 years, and it happened to be that the person who was teaching me was retiring. And he said, you know, you ought to think about teaching this class.
Huh.
I applied thinking, there's no way. And I went to work for a company in Richmond that was putting heavy equipment together for mining. And the school called me one day at the end of the summer and said, hey, would you interview? And sure enough, they hired me. I've been here ever since. And I still get that weird feeling that someone's going to come knocking on the door and say, we made that mistake. But it's worked out. I enjoy teaching. I didn't know how much I would enjoy teaching. And it still leaves room for all of the art and all of the other things that I enjoy.
What would you say motivates you to do great work with the students who are in your class?
At first, I was really just motivated by getting them through the program without looking like a fool. Because I went to work and thought that, you know, there's no way they're going to see me as someone who's able to teach them. I always kind of felt like a fraud every day. As I've grown up, I've learned to watch people who've graduated come up through the industry and do really well. Some of my students own their own welding companies now, and many of them still work in the same place that they did in 2013 and 2014. I can't think of anybody that I've had in class that has graduated and moved on who isn't working still.
That must be mighty gratifying and satisfying to see kind of like a proud papa, huh?
Much like that, and it makes me look forward to the next group of students.
Sean Gannon, assistant professor in the Certified Welding Educator Program at Bluegrass Community and Technical College in Lexington. Thanks so much, Sean.
Thank you, Tom.
Coming up after the break, our series Future Tense takes us into the world of disaster relief among marginalized communities. And Kentucky was one very confusing place to be during the Civil War, but not when it came to your fashion choices. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Support for WEKU and Eastern Standard comes from Hixson Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Shannon Church provide legal representation for auto accidents, medical malpractice, elder care, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-522-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.org or on the WEKU mobile app. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
Chris Bagley is back with our series Future Tense and some lessons to be learned from those who are left to fend for themselves when disaster strikes.
Today on Future Tense, we have Dr. Fatima Espinosa-Vasquez, a professor in the School of Information Science at the University of Kentucky. Her research is focused on the use of information and communication technology in times of profound change, including social movements and natural disasters. She looked at how resistant movements in Honduras used technology to organize and avoid censorship after the 2009 coup. She looked at how local community leaders in Puerto Rico used alternative socio-technological structures to recover after Hurricane Maria. Welcome, Fatima.
Hi, Chris. Thank you for having me.
I have to tell you that I'm a little envious as an archaeologist, where I'm always struggling to present the relevance of the work we do on things that happened 100 years ago. And all of your work seems incredibly relevant to us now when technology and catastrophes are on everybody's minds. I want to start by asking about your recent research in Puerto Rico. Can you tell me something about that?
Sure. I do study how marginalized communities particularly do this kind of organizing with technologies. And so before I tell you a little bit about it, I just wanted to sort of define what I mean by some of these things that I talk about. One of them is the idea of socio-technical infrastructure. So I study information technologies, but I take this socio-technical approach, which means that I don't only study the devices, the technologies themselves, but I also look at organizations and people and their ideas and how all these things work together. And the reason I do this is because I'm going to be mentioning this as I talk about Puerto Rico. So as you all know, Puerto Rico had a terrible hurricane in 2017. And when we watched the news, it was interesting to see that local civil society organizations were being very effective in providing relief as opposed to large institutions like FEMA, right? So I was curious about what makes these organizations be so effective. And so I conducted a study, and what I found out is that they were able to build this alternative socio-technical infrastructure using the resources that they had at hand. So basically, they were improvising new ways to getting organized and new ways to use the technologies, the little technologies that they had at hand at the time, because the whole electrical, technological, telecommunications, institutional infrastructure in Puerto Rico was completely obliterated, but civil society organizations and activists were still getting things done.
Could you give an example maybe of one of those types of technologies they were using?
Sure. This is the interesting thing, that it's not just one technology, so it's a combination of things. So what they're doing is sort of like a patchwork in bringing together many different types of technologies, many different types of organizations and people. So one example that I can think of is the case of Ronnie. I call them Ronnie and Claudia. These are pseudonyms because we try to protect their identities because they're activists. So Ronnie and Claudia, Ronnie was in Puerto Rico at the time, whereas Claudia was in Texas when the hurricane hit. There was no electricity. There was no cell phone signal. Of course, there was no internet where Ronnie was. However, by pure luck, he had access to a landline that was still working. And this was pure luck, right? But with this landline, he was able to get in touch with Claudia, who was in in Texas. They're both activists already, and they had already a network of collaborators. So through this line, they were able to have coordinating meetings with other activists outside of Puerto Rico who were part of a much larger network of, you know, Puerto Rican solidarity. And so they were able to organize like that because Claudia created a combination of Skype meetings with Zoom meetings and also cell phones and the landline. So it became this hybrid network of communication. But not only that, they were able to bring together all kinds of people, not only activists, but also individual citizens who wanted to support. And then they used a combination of the Postal Service with other carrier companies to bring those donations and resources that they have brought together through this organizing in the United States to Puerto Rico. And once in Puerto Rico, all the local civil society organizations there also organized in a way to distribute all the resources and the aid based on need, because they are the ones who know their needs better.
You know, now listening to this research, it really resonates, of course, with what we're all going through now, trying to, it feels like trying to cobble together systems that we can use to replace the in-person classrooms for our kids, or organizing and meeting needs in these other ways. You know, this reminds me a little bit of what went on in the Arab Spring back when social media really was the thing that enabled a lot of the protests there to get together. What attracted you initially to this type of work?
My research started working in Honduras, as you mentioned earlier, and I was most interested at the time on how, you know, activists during the coup d'etat in 2009 used technology. But as I conducted my research, I realized that there was more than that. There was the collective understandings of the injustices they were facing. And so the topic evolved into this more complex idea, and also the whole activity of improvising and creating these systems became very evident. And as you mentioned, and as we look through history, this is not something new. It really is something that has happened before. So I find it very interesting because it's especially marginalized populations who engage in this type of organizing using information technology.
If we look at some of these things that prompted people to use these or create these alternative structures or infrastructures, they're pretty dramatic events. The 2009 coup in Honduras, hurricanes, or now during the pandemic. But it's not always that sort of dramatic event. Can you talk a little bit about what prompts people to create or use these alternative structures?
Right. So there are a couple of things that need to happen. And you're right. It's not just during a disaster. It's also during what we can define as crisis, right? When people are in a perpetual state of precarity or crisis. So a couple of things need to happen. The crisis or the marginalization or the state of precarity, but also the shared understanding that there is something going on in the overall system. And what I mean by this is the state institutions. They need to think that there is some sort of misalignment between what the state priorities are in terms of policies and in terms of what they're actually investing on with people's needs. So if you look at the work of a lot of activists everywhere, you'll see that they are creating many different alternative ways to deal with the issues because the government systems are not addressing their needs.
Now, do you see that happening now during the pandemic?
Yes, I have been working with or meeting with a group of local organizations who work with immigrants, Latinx immigrants. And there is some level of organizing at that point because during the pandemic, the Latinx immigrant population here in Lexington have not been properly informed. It has been very difficult for them to access to official, reliable information. So there is something like that going on.
You know, one of the things that was interesting to me reading some of the papers you've written about your research was the way in which people identify what is a problem or what constitutes a problem and what constitutes a solution. And I know that you've thought a lot about how people frame problems, and, mm-hmm. and that, of course, is going to set up how they frame solutions. Mm-hmm. Is there something in your research that you feel is particularly relevant to what we're seeing now?
Yes, of course, many things. So one of the things is that most of these infrastructures that are created and the people that are building these infrastructures are not necessarily looking to restore the original infrastructure that was destroyed or the original or fix the infrastructure that is not working for them, because why would they want to restore something that is not working for them, right? And so that's one thing that I find very interesting, because a lot of effort goes into trying to restore what has been in place or trying to fix it when what underserved communities are looking for are something different. Yeah, and I think this is important because if we listen or pay attention to what they're doing, I think there are a lot of lessons to be learned. I think it's important to recognize their role that they're playing in crisis recovery. Right. And it is often overlooked. And I think it's also important to highlight that underserved communities are not just waiting for help, that they have agency, and that they have situated knowledge that is very valuable and that I think should be taken into account when making decisions about recovery or decisions about planning at high level.
I want to ask a little bit about what you see in the future. Here we've gone through this dramatic change. You see some examples of the kinds of things you've studied elsewhere happening right around us. What do you see in the future? Is this a hopeful type situation where, you know, you can create something better than what was? Or are there particular concerns?
I think that if, as a society, we continue in a path that it's increasing, you know, inequality and injustice, I think we will continue to see more of these systems. I don't think they're inherently bad, but I do think that they are a sign that there is structural injustice and that the structures in place are not helping. So I think we will begin to see more if we continue to have more inequality. We will continue to see more and more of those alternative systems, and they will continue to be more and more complex, I think. And at the same time, I think that we need to start acknowledging and listening to local organizations to sort of prevent, right? I think that could be a solution to first look at prevention, right? Because disaster and crisis are usually the result of structural problems. So if we were to listen to local organizations and local activists, I think it would prevent a lot of the issues that we get with disasters. And finally, I'd like to say that I see us in general, all of us as humans, needing to be part of a local community more and more. Because if things continue in the path that we are, I think we will need to rely more on smaller communities to get our needs met.
We've been talking with Dr. Fatima Espinosa-Vasquez, a professor in the School of Information Science at the University of Kentucky. It's really fascinating research, and I think something that really can help us understand what we're going through now. Thank you very much, Fatima.
Thank you, Chris.
And you can find past chapters of Chris Begley's Future Tense series on our website, esweku.org. Just click on the series tab, and you'll find it in the drop-down menu. The more things change, the more they remain the same. For example, the fashion choices that signal partisan loyalty. Today, that's often expressed in baseball caps and T-shirts bearing slogans and messages, but they didn't have baseball caps or colorful T-shirts back in the days of the Civil War, 160 years ago. But they did, nonetheless, publicly mark their partisan preferences through their clothing. Amy Merle Taylor is a professor of history at the University of Kentucky and an historian of the American South. Her work focuses on the era of the Civil War, Emancipation, and Reconstruction, and she has studied the significance of clothing for an essay in the Register of the Kentucky Historical Society. It's entitled Texts and Textiles in Civil War Kentucky. Thanks for joining us, Amy.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, what inspired you to look into this connection between fashion and partisan statement?
Well, it sort of evolved. I mean, on the one hand, I'm a social historian, which means I'm concerned with everyday life. I always want to try to understand how people lived from day to day. You know, I'm less concerned with high politics and more about everyday survival. And when I started working on this article, I was just finishing up a book manuscript about the end of slavery in the United States that looked at people who went and lived in Union Army lines in what were essentially refugee camps and focused a lot on, you know, their shelter, their food, their clothing, these, you know, very essential things to survival. And so I was thinking a lot about what can we learn from the past about looking at what we often consider to be the sort of mundane, the sort of backdrop. You know, the things historians don't always take seriously when they're looking at the big documents of the past. So I sat down to explore a new digital archive that the Kentucky Historical Society put together called the Civil War Governors of Kentucky. And it's a collection of all sorts of writings of ordinary people in the Commonwealth during the Civil War. It's their letters to the governor, their pardon applications. And I kept seeing references to clothing. People were stealing clothing. They're fighting over clothing. I mean, they're getting accused of one crime, but details about clothing enter into their paperwork. And so, being the sort of historian that I am, having just been thinking about the importance of clothing, I was really struck that in these documents, there'd be so much talk. So that's kind of where it came from. What is going on here? That's what I was trying to figure out.
Interesting. So let's time machine back to the Civil War years. Kentucky was a border state, of course, a very confusing place where Unionists become Confederates, Confederates become Unionists. Many held allegiance to whichever force was, at the moment, using the family farmhouse as a field hospital. And clothing, as you've written, offered the sort of distinguishing mark of position that could sort out people. Tell us what you've learned about the role of clothing in that scenario.
Well, I think it plays a unique role in Kentucky because Kentucky was pretty unique in this war. I mean, this, as you say, was a place where Unionists and Confederates lived side by side, but people were sometimes going back and forth from one allegiance to another, which meant then that Kentuckians, and I'm talking about white Kentuckians in particular, often strained to figure out who was who. Who was an enemy? Who was an ally? Loyalty could not be assumed in a place like this. It had to be proven, and it had to be found out. I mean, people had to make their loyalty known. This was deadly serious, because this could make all the difference of whether they survived in this war. So at a time like this, when, you know, they don't have ID cards to establish who they are, what they believe in, clothing offered a visual cue. It kind of fixed their status as a Union or a Confederate and determined how they would be seen by other people. So clothing had always been wrapped up with asserting one's class or race or gender position in society, but now it takes on a new political significance in Civil War Kentucky that I think reveals a lot about how chaotic this place was.
Well, what are some ways that choices of what to wear could determine the way humans lived or survived the war?
Well, again, it could make all the difference. I mean, it could, how one was seen and perceived could determine whether they would be protected or not. Or to provide an example, say a man, he goes off and enlists in a Union regiment, or maybe it's a Confederate regiment, and just wants to give up. He can't take it anymore, and he deserts. Well, he's got a uniform on, and if he is seen walking around in some town on his own, it's going to be pretty clear that he is this deserter from his army. So obtaining civilian clothing, which some of these deserters did, often by theft, and putting that on could save that man from violent retaliation for desertion. So it was, in that respect, it was really essential to his survival.
You write about Confederate guerrillas who use clothing as a tool of stealth and mention one of John Hunt Morgan's spies, a fellow by the name of Bill Owens, who liked to cross-dress to fool his targets. Did it work?
Right. Well, not in his case, although it worked in some others. So he wasn't the only man who also dressed in women's clothing. And in Bill Owens's case, he's a spy, so he's trying to not so much blend in, maybe, but sort of make sure nobody's scrutinizing him. You know, the people aren't necessarily paying attention. And in his mind, in the mind of some other men, dressing in women's clothing was the way to go because women at this time are not supposed to be political. So they calculated that other people weren't necessarily paying attention to women's clothing quite so much or paying attention to women at all. So Bill Owens, he dressed like a woman. And he was in Lexington, and it did not work. He was found out, and Union authorities showed up where he was sleeping and arrested him for his work as a spy. So he didn't quite pull it off, but some other men did. And although I don't really write about it in this article, women, of course, are famous during the Civil War for dressing in men's clothing in order to serve, which in some cases, it's a costume, but it's also for some of those women, they were probably more like what we would call transgender today. You know, women who really felt a calling to fight as men in this war.
Well, what were some more conspicuous ways that civilians wore their loyalty?
Well, I can tell you about some of the women, again, in Lexington. They sort of played with color and the design of fabric as a way to make their loyalty known. So one case, I remember reading the correspondence of a couple, and she was Unionist and he was Confederate. And she was determined to kind of poke him by making a dress out of stars and stripes calico, so American flags all over her. She was going to wear this dress around to bother him. But there were also, in September 1862, this is a time in the Civil War in Kentucky, when the Battle of Richmond had just taken place. Confederates are victorious, so they're riding high coming out of Richmond. They come into Lexington and force the evacuation of Union forces from Lexington. And they come in triumphant, and the Confederate sympathizers in Lexington suddenly come out of the woodwork in order to cheer them on. Church bells ring and women start lining the streets, and they're wearing these dresses that are described as having red and white streamers hanging down from them. Now, I haven't seen any kind of picture to visualize this, but those red and white stripes, yes, they're on the American flag, but they're also at this time on the Confederate national flag. And so this was very much a signal of their Confederate loyalty as they're cheering on General Kirby Smith's troops as they come into Lexington.
Interesting. So in the time that we have, I want to jump over to the other side of this.
Mm-hmm.
And you write about how clothing signaled that somebody had made the transition from slave to mm-hmm. a free person. Talk to us about that a bit.
Sure. So what I've talked about so far was really kind of a white phenomenon where they're trying to figure out who was Unionist or Confederate. That wasn't such a question for African-American people in Kentucky who were Unionist, but they are making a transition from slavery to freedom. And this plays out through clothing, and clothing becomes a way to assert freedom for many of these people becoming emancipated. So the most obvious example were men who enlisted in the Army and suddenly wearing the blue uniform of the United States, which became sort of a powerful symbol of their claim of freedom and their claim to citizenship in the United States. It was a very distinguishing mark. For women, the story was a little different and less straightforward because, of course, they didn't have the military uniform that they could grab onto. But they, too, are encountering new sources of clothing because many of the women and children, like the men who are enlisting, are fleeing slavery. And the women and children are taking up residence behind the lines of the Union Army. And there, they start encountering Northern missionaries and organizations that are sending clothing from the North into the South. Because some of these women, they have fled slavery with literally nothing more than the clothing on their backs. So they are in need. So there are new opportunities for them to dress differently and to dress in a way that they associate with freedom or in which they can assert more control over what is on their body, because some of their clothing in slavery had simply been mandated to them by their owner and was made in some cases by a very coarse fabric known at the time as Negro cloth. Well, now they have the opportunity to seek something very different to wear and to express their individuality with new sources of clothing.
And Dr. Taylor, the title of your book?
It's Embattled Freedom, Journeys Through the Civil War's Slave Refugee Camps.
One quick final question. I wonder what parallels you are seeing between fashion choices of the Civil War era that you've written about and today?
Well, in style, they're very different, to be sure. I mean, I'm a woman wearing shorts right now. But I think the inclination to wear one's politics and assert one's self through one's clothing has certainly persisted over time. Maybe the 21st century way of expressing politics is through a T-shirt. That's a pretty common way to do it. But it's certainly no less contested today. And I think, you know, right now we're talking in the midst of a pandemic, and there's a lot of talk about wearing masks, which maybe isn't exactly an item of clothing, but we do wear it on our bodies. And, you know, there are some questions now about whether wearing a mask is becoming a partisan statement or not. So I think that sort of contestation we see about clothing today is really just something I saw in the Civil War, but in a different form.
Amy Merle Taylor is a professor of history at the University of Kentucky and historian of the American South, whose work focuses on the era of the Civil War, Emancipation, and Reconstruction. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And speaking of icons of the Civil War, the United Daughters of the Confederacy is threatening to sue Davis County over the relocation of a Confederate statue. From member station WKYU, Lisa Autry has details.
Davis Fiscal Court voted in August to create a committee to recommend sites for the 120-year-old monument of a Confederate soldier that stands on the lawn of the county courthouse. During a meeting on Wednesday, committee member Ann Dameron said she had spoken to members of the Kentucky chapter of the United Daughters of the Confederacy.
They have a deed. They own the statue. They are prepared to sue. They already have two lawyers, and they're going to sue. They have about five locations where they would like to move it.
The UDC hasn't publicly revealed those five sites, and the Kentucky chapter didn't respond to a request for comment. The relocation committee has reached out to several entities to gauge their interest in becoming the monument's new home. The Owensboro Museum of Science and History has expressed high interest, while Elmwood Cemetery and the Owensboro Museum of Fine Art have declined to house the statue. The public comment period is being extended through November 9th. I'm Lisa Autry in Bowling Green.
That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson, our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard online at weku.org or esweku.org. On the WEKU mobile app or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And we do like to hear from you. Send us your ideas. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.